Hi there, it's 1:55 in the morning. I'm at Anthony's house, coming to you live from the field, and I'm here with official Lucky Paper Radio commander correspondent Daniel.
Hello, Daniel can be your commander.
Daniel, we just had a match where I think between the two of us, we gained round about 100 life?
90, 100 life? Yeah.
And I gotta ask, how are you feeling about life gain at this moment, given that it is, again, I'm going to repeat, 1:55 a.m.?
I believe that had we started at 2 o'clock, I would not feel so hateful towards life gain. But given that I know, oh God, it hurts. But I love it. It's going to stay. And okay. You're wrong about the Selesnya Avengel.
I mean, oh, you think a Selesnya Avengel can get there?
Absolutely wrong about it.
What's the real sex in that card again? Green, white for a 1/2, and yeah, you pay one and tap it to make a sapperling.
Yeah.
I'm ready to be proven wrong about that.
All right, great. Well, I didn't get it, so I couldn't do it. But great. If you have what I had, it's perfect.
Take mine.
Danny Wheatley can be your commander.
Okay, it's Andy again. I'm walking home now. Now it's 2:10 a.m. I just wanted to clarify that. That was a game of the gold cube, Daniel's gold cube, not some kind of commander game. That was a cube game, one-on-one, 40-card decks, heads up, 100 life gained over the entire match. Also, this is the only intro you get this week. I don't have time to do anything fun because I'm staying up until 2 o'clock in the morning playing Magic. And may that be an example to you all. Anyway, welcome to Lucky Paper Radio. I am your host, Andy, and I'm here with my co-host, Anthony, Master COVID Dodger Maddox. You're still clean. You're still unsullied.
As far as I know.
Yeah, as far as you know. It finally got to me. It got to Hillary first and then came from me, given that we live in the same home and there was no way to really distance from her. And I was like, I wasn't going to do that. Some people were like, did you distance from her? I'm like, I'm not going to like try and quarantine in my own house. It's not going to happen.
I'm reminded of some bizarre character. I think I want to say that John Malkovich plays in some movie where he's just extremely paranoid and hiding under rocks and stuff. And maybe that's a little bit how I feel right now. You're saying I'm a master COVID dodger. Maybe I've just been staying home.
Yeah. I mean, it works. The strategy works. It turns out. It's funny. My relationship to John Malkovich as an actor, I'm not a big movie guy. We never really talk about movies, but most movies fall into the same category as like fiction books for me, where it's just not how I want to spend my time. And I'm like, I don't know. It doesn't really do it for me. So my real only experience with John Malkovich is the movie Being John Malkovich. And I couldn't really wrap my head around how this person already had a meta joke about them, even though I was not even aware of them as a cultural figure. And yet there was a meta movie about the actor.
I mean, it's not really about the actor. I do wonder if when they wrote that movie, if
the
they,
movie
if
is written, called Being John Malkovich.
Correct,
Anthony.
But you could have swapped in any other person.
Could you have?
Yeah, of course. I mean,
take that, John Malkovich.
John Malkovich did a great job. I don't think it would have been great.
Malkovich.
I think his name did contribute a lot to the title and that particular scene.
He played it very well. Again, I don't know much else about the man because that's really the one major movie
He's
I've seen
actor.
With him in it. But I can't really imagine another actor pulling that off. Like, can you imagine a movie called Being Adrian Brody? What's that? That's not a thing.
Yes. It would be a little bit more intense.
I wouldn't want to watch that movie, but I liked Being John Malkovich.
Well, I'm glad you're back. I'm glad you're feeling better and healed up.
Yeah, I feel fine. I got moderately sick, I would say. Not as bad as Hillary. I had like mild flu symptoms, but friendly reminder that the virus is still out there and it's trying to get you. It's trying to get us all.
How's your sense of smell? That's what really scares me.
I haven't lost any sense of smell or taste, but Hillary has lost weird amounts of smell and taste.
Yikes.
Like, she's like quietly really not been enjoying any of the meals I've been cooking. And then I'm like, hey, how's that sense of taste doing? She's like, I don't know. You keep making bland dinners. And I'm like, I don't know if I am doing that.
Oh, that's so sad.
But she can smell them. I don't know. We'll see how
I hope it comes
we'll
back.
We'll see how it evolves. It's one of those things where it's like, I feel like you would get used to it pretty quickly.
Like, no, I don't think so.
I think you would because like I'm partially deaf in one ear from a bad ear infection I got my freshman year of college, the year we met, Anthony.
This is going to be a fun episode. We're just going through all the little ailments.
And So I had this bad ear infection that I ignored a little bit and then it stopped hurting. And I was like, well, I guess it's healed. But I like had this feeling of my ear had to pop, and then it just never popped. And after a few months, I just got used to it. And it's just like, oh yeah, I can hear it just fine. And
that's what you applied to everything else in your life, that experience?
I just think when your sensory input changes, like, everything's relative. So, like, to some degree, if your, like, taste changed, you would definitely notice for, like, a couple weeks. But then at some point, like, you have to, like, be able to really summon the sense memory of, like, what does something that's really flavorful or salty or whatever taste like. And I think it'd be really hard to do that. And eventually you'd be like, well, is this the sweetest thing I've had in the past 6 months or the spiciest thing I've had in the last 6 months? I have no idea what aspects of flavor even affected by COVID.
Or you just don't enjoy it anymore because there's no flavor there.
Maybe.
That was a very scary thing going into this whole situation for me, because Harold McGee, one of my all-time favorite, just favorite people.
Dudes.
I love Harold McGee.
Top 10 dudes.
He's a food writer, largely, and experienced at some point in the past, for some reason, anosmia for a number of months. And just listening to him talk about...
Was it because he did some weird experiment where he, like, ate something he wasn't supposed to eat? That's the kind of thing Harold McGee would do, I feel like.
I don't think so. But
he didn't
just
snort a line of those magic berries that make make sour things taste sweet?
I can't prove he didn't. Just hearing the sort of sincere sadness in his voice about how he just, like, didn't enjoy food anymore and just didn't want to eat was just... That certainly colored my thinking about COVID, for sure.
It would be very sad to lose my sense of taste, though I gotta say, it might be a little bit healthy for me, because I love eating so much right now. To not want to eat a little bit would be a nice reprieve, maybe.
I'm just leaning into it.
For health reasons. Anyway, on this episode of the podcast, I want to return to the thing I've alluded to a couple times that we've gotten a couple of questions about, which is my refusal to accept the broadly spread heuristic that aggro beats control beats mid-range, and mid-range beats aggro, and that the magic metagame can be described with this sort of rock, paper, scissors cycle that all the decks relate to each other in. So I want to talk about those concepts, where they maybe come from. I did my best to try and, like, get to some sense of, like, canonical articles and resources where these ideas came from, and then why I don't necessarily agree with that overall rule of thumb that people seem to make a lot of magic decisions based on. But before we get to that, we're going to do a pack one, pick one from a listener-submitted cube. This week, our cube comes to us from listener Arcade. This is a commander cube, Anthony. And the way the cube works is we have a pack of 12 cards, which is the commander pack, which is the first pack we open. This pack is mostly legendary creatures, all of which can be commanders of our commander deck we're going to draft. There are also some conspiracies intentionally seeded into the pack here. And we're going to get two picks out of this pack. So it's a pack one, pick two. I presume this is drafted in the same style as Commander Legends. That was pick two out of every pack, right?
I believe so, yeah.
So I assume that we're drafting in a pot of four, but so we get two picks out of every pack. Any overall observations before we dive into this specific pack?
I don't think so. I want to just dive in and start talking about it in the context of some cards.
All right, so the pack is Narset Enlightened Master, the Locust God, Lord Wingrace, Jor Kadeen the Prevailer, Bruce Tarl, Boorish Herder, Silas Wren, Seeker Adept, Kamal, Heart of Krosa, Natural Unity, Immediate Action, Adriana's Valor, Slow Bad Goblin Tinkerer, and Grand Arbiter Augustine the Fourth. You get two picks out of this pack. What are you gonna do?
As I often say, this is really difficult. So there's this weird tension in a commander cube, especially with the color identity, where I kind of want to take the most cards that have the most colors in them, right? Because I just want to be able to play the most cards, have the most flexibility in the draft itself. At the same time, if I draft one of these cards that has more colors, I might just end up not being able to include it in my deck if I switch into a different commander. So I think that it's still correct to lean towards more colors, but ultimately I'm also just looking at the power level of the cards in this pack. I think the Locust God has got to be the safest bet here. What do you think?
Well, you get two picks, so...
I get two picks, so...
That's one of them. What's your second pick?
Second pick, I think I would go with Jor Kadeen. I'm not sure that is the correct pick from a power level perspective, but if I was doing a little bit of metagaming, depending on who I'm sitting at with the table, red-white is often not super favored in commander games, so just being able to say, hey, let's just choose this card that I think is going to be pretty well supported in this equipment theme and feel like I can really get the full experience of what that equipment theme is like here.
All reasonable thoughts, I think. I haven't looked at the whole list, but I gotta say my first reaction to this pack is I feel like we really got unlucky with our conspiracy slots, because I think there are three conspiracies guaranteed in this pack based on how the packs are seeded. And these conspiracies are all kind of duds. I mean, conspiracies as a card type have the opportunity to be extremely broken. I'm not sure if, right. if most broken ones are in this cube, but all these conspiracies are the hidden agenda ones, which basically augment a specific card in your deck that you then still have to draw and play. So they play in a very different space than the conspiracies that just give you an effect every game.
I do actually really like the design of these conspiracies, though, because
yeah, they're cool designs.
Those other kinds, you know, that say, you know, you can, your lands are every color, or totally like change the
you
way your deck is.
You can just kind of do whatever you want.
You can just kind of do whatever you want. Those are cool, but you do have that effect every single game, and they can be super powerful. So if you're playing with those cards a lot, they can get a little bit tired. So these designs where they actually function a little bit more like a normal Magic card, where there's some variance to whether or not they actually have an impact on any given game, and that combination of as you're drafting, you're figuring out what you're going to try and pair with them. I think they're very cool cards. So you're definitely going to play them if you take them, but they're just not at that power level where you're trying to take them early, I think.
Yeah, from a designer hat perspective, I think they are very cool. From a player hat perspective, I'm like, well, darn, none of these are that great in terms of power level, and so is somebody else going to get a much more powerful one than I am? For example, like, I would consider Sentinel Dispatch, which I think most people think is a pretty innocuous conspiracy, but that's just one that says you start the game with a 1/1 colorless construct artifact creature token with Defender. That's a conspiracy I would take over anything in this pack, just because I think that's kind of messed up to have that every single game. But the ones we have are not that, so I'm not taking any of the conspiracies here. And next on my list of things I'm looking for out of this cube is...
Can I change my mind real quick before you influence me?
Of course.
I think that the right choice is actually probably just the partners, right?
He fucking took all my thunder.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I was going to say, the next thing I'm noticing out of his pack is that I think the partner mechanic is pretty busted in a couple of ways. Having a card in the command zone is very powerful. We saw this with companions, right? Where we
just
introduced
an eighth card, no matter right. what it is going to be powerful.
We saw this with the companion mechanic. You introduce an eighth card into a otherwise normal game of Magic, and that's a very powerful thing. Obviously, everybody has access to that in a commander cube, so that's not a unique thing. It's going to set apart your deck from the others, which is what made companion mechanics so warping, because it was kind of like, well, now is every deck in the constructed metagame a companion deck, or is every other deck just starting at a big disadvantage? And then partner allows you to not only be flexible with what cards you end up playing in the future, but more importantly, just lets you have two cards in the command zone. So if you ask me to like rank the raw power level of these cards once in play, I would say that it's probably like Lord Windgrace, the Locust God, are like the two most powerful cards in the pack.
Although Lord Windgrace, I ding a little bit just because in a multiplayer game, it's going to be a lot easier to attack planeswalkers. So I think... having a planeswalker that especially you can have access to multiple times is powerful, but less powerful than if it wasn't a multiplayer environment.
That's true, though I still have noted that people are unwilling to leave themselves open to any kind of counterattack. Like, people just don't like attacking in Commander. And maybe this cube is designed to strongly encourage that, in which case, to your point, Lord Windgrace would be a bit of a liability. But it's a very powerful card in its three colors.
For
so,
sure.
Like, that definitely stood out to me. I'm not particularly excited about Bruce Tarl, Silas Wren, or Kamal, but I'm definitely taking two of those because they are all partner commanders. They all can play with each other, and we're going to get more picks out of his commander pack. And so I'm really just trying to set myself up with the most broad range of potential partner combinations I can for my deck. And I'm going to take that strategy when drafting this cube until it is demonstrated to me through some games that that is not the best thing to be doing. So I think if you like made me choose, I would probably take just Bruce Tarl and Silas Wren.
Yeah, I think that's a good option. Like,
it gives you four colors. I think Kamal is a more appealing commander than both of them, but I think just being across four colors and two partners in the beginning is too much potential to leave on the table.
For sure. It also just gives you the most flexibility. If you end up getting another partner later on, you can mix and match your colors
precisely.
In a much more powerful way.
Precisely. So if I'm reading this correctly, we are going to leave... I guess it depends how many conspiracies we take. We're going to leave this pack with a lot of commanders we can potentially choose from, right? Because we're going to get 12 cards out of this commander pack, which is some combination of commanders and conspiracies. And so that's honestly maybe...
That's a good point. Maybe we should just be taking... But we can still put the other cards in our deck. So it's not like we are...
Yeah, as I'm saying that, though, maybe it's just like, maybe you just take the conspiracies because you can play as many of those as you want. I don't know. I'm still sticking by the partners. I think this isn't a format I have to play a couple times to get a good sense of. And the fact that it is multiplayer is going to... be self-correcting more than regular one-on-one draft even, where if you do draft a lot better than your other opponents, you still might lose in the game if you don't navigate the politics of a multiplayer game correctly. So it can be a hard environment, I think, to really spike and evaluate on a spike-based level. But I'm taking partners, I think, is all I'm going to do.
I think that's the right choice. And I also think that, you know, there's some tension here, which I might be a little bit critical of. But on the other hand, that tension can also be positive. Like every feature in a game can also be a bug. It just depends on what aspect brings you joy. So I'm excited. We haven't played a lot of multiplayer cubes or a lot of Commander or Brawl cubes. So I think this year we'll probably end up doing a little bit more of that. And I'm excited to see sort of what we learn.
I really don't like the art on Bruce Tarr or Silas Wren. Like, it's got to be said. I think they're both D-tier magic art.
Yeah, that Sadox is not doing much for me.
I don't know if... I get the impression that they have a lower budget for the art for Commander products. And maybe that's not the case anymore, but for some reason, it's just like the Commander products never have... You know what also might be part of that is that prior to like the past couple years, the Commander products kind of existed like in a art directionless space. Like now it's very clearly like this plane gets Commander decks. Before it was just kind of like every year we do Commander decks and... They're not on a plane or part of a story. They're just like cards. And I wonder if that lack of art direction leads to a little bit less inspired art. Thank you, Arcade, for sending in this pack. I'm curious to know what you think we should be doing. Arcade said in their email that you had to choose kind of between the flexibility of choosing multicolored commanders and the raw power level of choosing conspiracies. I don't think any of these conspiracies are dripping out as raw power level to me. We're looking at natural unity, immediate action, Adriana's valor. So for us, I think it's kind of just a question of how to stay open and keep yourself flexible. And for me, it's just taking the two colored partners. And it sounds like Anthony came around to that as well.
Yeah, but I also want more now to take either the Scarab God or Jor-Kadeen, which are these like much more just compelling cards that tell you to do a certain thing. Like they have a much stronger theme about them, which is really appealing.
I think this is the kind of environment where if you just want to do a sweet thing, I think you will be much less punished here than you would be punished
right.
So if you're just down to have fun and you're not trying to spike the multiplayer draft. I mean, spiking multiplayer draft is honestly
it's also really hard.
It's not a great sentence. I'm not really excited about that goal of spiking the multiplayer draft,
yeah.
But I can't deny my spike roots. Anyway, if you want to have your cube on Lucky Paper Radio, send us a link to it on Cube Cobra to mail@luckypaper.co with your name and pronouns, and we will crack a pack on the show. Aggro, mid-range, control, combo, aggro control, ramp, burn. Anthony, what do you think of these words?
Well, I mean, it's pretty clear and built up from history that aggro beats control. Oh, God, I've done it backwards.
No, that was right. You did it right.
Went in the wrong order, so it's getting hard for me. Mid-range beats aggro, control beats mid-range, and then aggro beats control, as everyone knows. And the rest of those words you said are just out there.
I want to start high level here, which is just to talk about these concepts in general, right? Because I think sometimes people don't recognize that these ideas, aggro, mid-range, control, any other kinds of descriptive terms to describe the tempo and value and shape of a game of Magic, the strategy of a deck very broadly, these are all like made-up thought technologies, right? These are not an intrinsic part of the game. There are no Magic cards that say aggro card, mid-range card, control card on them. These are just patterns, essentially. You're trying to think of cards that actually say that somewhere.
Control Magic, obviously. Aggressive Mammoth?
I don't think that's one. Maybe it is.
It might be.
Anyway, these are not things that are actually part of the game system, right? These are ideas that people have invented to describe patterns they have observed in decks that are successful. And for me, I think it's important to keep that pattern in mind, right? Because when you look at a given standard metagame or a constructed metagame, whether it's Modern or Legacy or whatever, it's not that one of these things is the most successful because Legacy favors aggro or control or whatever. It's that the specific cards that are put into specific decks make for successful decks. And then afterwards, we look at those successful decks and try and describe the patterns we're observing.
Right. So these are emergent aspects of the system.
Right. And they're emergent aspects that people have tried to wrangle and name over the years. And frankly, I thought before I like tried to look this up, there was going to be a more comprehensive, canonical, like, here's what the macro archetypes of Magic are. In my head, it's basically always aggro, mid-range, and control. Combo is another thing, and to me, like, that's always felt like a deck that usually kind of fits into one of the other categories as well, but its win condition is just a combo instead of something else. Like, you could be a combo deck that has a lot of controlling elements. You could be a fast combo deck, which is essentially aggro combo. You could be a mid-range combo deck somewhere in between. I always felt like that was a different kind of thing. It didn't really fit into the normal categorization of options. But I asked around on Twitter, I did some Googling, and The best examples I can find of this are like going all the way back to, I think, 2010. It was actually kind of shaky on the published date of this. Patrick Chapin wrote a book called Next Level Magic, and then another book called Next Level Deck Building, which has a very deep and robust description of what he considers to be the archetypal shapes and decks of magic. And for him, on a high level, it's aggro, mid-range, control, and combo. And then within each of those, there's a bunch of subcategories. I've read Next Level Deck Building. I personally don't think Chapin's ideas have that kind of like elegance and clarity that makes them sticky. I find some holes personally in some of his definitions of decks that I don't think hold up and make sense. I don't think a lot of his descriptors are consistent. And because of that, I don't think it's really become the one way everyone talks about it. And as an example of that, in 2012, Zach Hill wrote an article for Wizards of the Coast where he describes the Triforce of Magic, which he says is aggro, control, and combo, no mid-range, and then describes later on in the article a revised Triforce of Magic, which includes aggro, mid-range, control, combo, but also includes ramp and disruptive aggro, which so now there's 5 points on this Triforce. It's a Quinn force or whatever, a pent force. And then in 2017, Jennifer Long wrote an article called The Metagame Clock, which similarly described the old model of magic, which again was aggro, control, and combo. And then her revised options are aggro, mid-range, control, combo, and aggro control, which I can assume is the same thing meant by disruptive aggro in Zach Hill's articles. And as soon as you start reading any of these, they all get really complicated and muddied, and it's hard to really... I honestly don't think any of these systems laid out by any of these people are elegant and simple enough to become sticky so that they just become the canonical way everyone talks about this. But there's a lot of common threads, right? These all contain aggro as an archetype. They all contain control as an archetype. They all contain combo as an archetype. Only some of them contain mid-range, which is interesting. I'm curious to know, Anthony, what do these terms mean to you?
So, I mean, it sounds like you're thinking about these terms in a very concrete sense, where it's like there are decks that are exactly one of these attributes, and there are these rules about who wins a matchup. And I don't totally agree with you, because I think there is a lot that is useful about these terms, but they're more just tendencies or abstract descriptors about one aspect about decks, not that can capture the entirety of what every deck is about. I mean, because that's what's awesome about Magic, is the rich, complex, muddy messiness of it, that everything is a little bit different and has its own texture, its own strategy, its own little nuances about it. But having some anchor points to lay out sort of certain spectrums of aspects of decks, I think, is really useful. So in that sense, just to say, the game has a tempo, like games take a certain amount of time, and where your deck is targeting to resolve itself, to resolve its plan, really does say a lot about your strategy. And so I think having this one axis of time makes a lot of sense to me. And in that aspect, I do think those rules roughly hold true, but there's so much other context that just, like you're saying, does make it really hard to actually see the canonical example where that actually holds true. I mean, the other aspect is also just that when you say mid-range beats aggro, it doesn't mean mid-range always beats aggro. It might mean they have a few percentage points of advantage in a given matchup.
Right. Even a 60-40 matchup is really, heavily skewed, right? If you look at the best Magic players of all time, their win percentages across all the Magic they've played approaches about 60%. That's like Paulo Vitor, Dominic Rosa, John Finkel, these kinds of players. So even if you're the best player in the world, you're going to lose 40% of your games. Even if a matchup is really good, you still might lose 40% of those games anyway. I agree. I agree with everything you said. I think there's a like general idea here, which kind of makes sense and I think rings true to people's experience playing Magic. And that's why we see these common threads of all of these individual thought technologies or ways to think about Magic. And I also agree that when each of these authors tries to get comprehensive and rigorous and specific enough to try and cover all possible decks, that's where you can start to poke holes and see like, well, actually, it doesn't really make sense.
Right.
And is The Rock really one of the 16 main decks you can do in Magic? Like, how many decks in the past 4 years can you describe as The Rock? Like, all these like weird questions kind of come up.
Yeah, I mean, I think that these are not so much a heuristic as much as just a system of categorizing, which where I think that's useful is you might say, okay, you're in some matchup, you're playing the control deck, you know your opponent's playing the aggro deck. Start as a baseline with this idea of where is the risk. The risk is your opponent's going to get under you and beat you before you are able to execute your own plan. And so starting with that risk and that, you know, abstract sense of how you're categorizing things, then maybe you change the deck in a certain way, or you have a sideboard plan or some other way to break that. So it doesn't necessarily mean that you're always, you know, unfavored of that matchup, but you have a baseline to target from.
That's why I think these ideas are most useful, in that they begin to give you an explanation for what's happening, right? If you are like, I keep losing this game, I don't understand why, my cards are better than my opponent's, and the explanation is that simply, well, your opponent's deck is much more efficient than yours, it pressures you early, and then you
you're
don't
dead
have enough
with four
ways.
Cards left in your hands.
Right. It really, all these, like, the reason these archetypes even exist is just to furnish us with explanations for why certain decks are favored in certain matchups, right? That's kind of the whole reason we have a thing called aggro. Like, aggro is just defined as the deck that, once it's turn 12, is probably not favored anymore, right? Like, that's kind of what we invented all these terms to be. Given all that, Anthony, how would you, in your own terms, define these major archetypes of on this spectrum of speed?
Ask your question in a different way, because, like, I think it is just a question of, I think it is largely a question of speed versus value, but how that really manifests is going to depend entirely on the context that we're talking about.
I guess another thing I want to, like, express here is that I think people start to think that these categories have, like, a definitiveness and a comprehensiveness that isn't appropriate, because they really are the result of the cards that have been printed and happen to be good, right? Like, I think about Delver Decks and Legacy. Let's say Delver Decks and Legacy prior to Modern Horizons 2, when they got Dragon's Rage Channeler and Ragavan and got additional Delvers, right? Like, prior to that, that deck only existed because of Delver of Secrets. That's why it's called a Delver deck, right? Like, the idea of a deck that would play really cheap threats and basically hold up interaction and protection for them otherwise isn't really a thing in Legacy, and to my knowledge, was never really a thing. That whole archetype sprang out of the viability of that one specific card in the context of that metagame. Some of these thought technologies describe ramp as a whole major pillar of a Magic metagame. That's just because some cards happen to ramp. It's entirely possible that Wizards could print new cards that defy any of these categorizations and create decks that people have not seen before. I honestly think companion decks kind of break a lot of these rules, right? Like Lurrus decks before they got banned in Modern. I don't know how you would categorize a lot of them here, because a lot of them were very low to the ground, were fairly aggressive, but had this incredibly grindy late game value engine in the form of Lurrus compared with things like Mishra's Bauble. That just meant that all of the, like, supposed weaknesses of the supposed aggro deck just weren't there anymore. Now it could, like, draw more cards than your blue deck in the late game because of this card it always had access to.
Yeah, that raises a big question that I have, which is, has this changed dramatically? Like, are these emergent properties that will always emerge to some degree, there being, you know, this variable speed of decks in any environment? Or has the design, the fundamental design of Magic cards changed enough that maybe these look completely different than they used to? A big part of it is, I think, that there's just so many more cards printed today as opposed to 5-10 years ago that just generate so much card advantage that I don't know if you have as stark this picture of value versus tempo, because now the players that are trying to be aggressive can also generate tremendous value. So it's like, does it, when you're playing Ragavan, does it even make sense to think of this as an aggro card when it's giving you kind of the best of both worlds?
Yeah, I would say Ragavan is not really an aggro card. You'll just play it in a deck that has red mana.
Yeah, well,
like,
yeah.
Like, the rest of your deck does not need to be committed to killing your opponent quickly for that card to be extremely, extremely good.
Right.
You know, I think really, when you look at a constructed metagame, which is where all of these terms and thought technologies come from, like, what is successful in that metagame is just whatever cards happen to be good, right? And the cards that are part of that metagame, the cards that are in the pool of available cards to build your deck from, that is the only thing that dictates what decks have good or bad matchups against other decks or not. It doesn't, like, there's no fundamental aggro is weak to mid-range, because you could have a format where aggro just has a bunch of incredible one mana removal spells, a bunch of flame slashes. It just means that mid-range can never get on the ground or can never stabilize with creatures and block. And so in that metagame, it's mid-range is not favored against aggro. And in that same metagame, you might have control decks that have a bunch of pyroclasms and toxic deluges and, like, really cheap board wipes. And now it's like, okay, well, even though the inherited, like, broad general heuristic is supposed to be that aggro beats control, if you imagine a pretty simple metagame where aggro decks have a bunch of cheap removal, control decks have a bunch of cheap board wipes, then you can pretty quickly invent a metagame where, like, those rules just completely break down. So I think to some degree, the speed axis and having faster decks, slower decks, and I think inherently that sort of third node is kind of emergent because the decks are only fast relative to each other, right? In every matchup, one deck is fast, one deck is slow. There is no third deck. But when you think about decks that are going to have some matchups where they are the fast deck and some matchups where they're the slow deck, that's where mid-range becomes emergent. You have to be able to play both sides of that coin, I think. It's how I think of that term and define it. So I think that speed axis is intrinsic to the game, and I don't think it's been as completely negated by the printing of more value cards over time. I think the logic that people have largely assumed that, oh, there's this rock, paper, scissors where these decks are disfavored, I think that is the more flawed idea that does just fall apart as new cards are printed and there's more powerful options at different parts of the curve.
I mean, do you think it's actually fundamentally flawed, or you just think that it is a broad baseline, which in practice is not as useful as maybe it is applied?
I don't mean flawed as in it's worthless, right? I just mean flawed in the sense that it's not an intrinsic trait of the fastest decks in a meta that they are always disfavored against the next fastest decks in the meta, the one step slower, the mid-range decks. I don't think that is at all intrinsic. I think there's been historically some observations for that. And I have another theory for why this is a thing that people kind of assume, which we'll get into. Basically, I think you should have explanations to describe every direction of this like triad, right? You should be able to explain how an aggro deck beats a control deck. And that's the argument you've heard a bunch, right? The aggro deck just has a bunch of cheap threats and gets the control deck dead before the control deck can execute its strategy. We have an explanation for that. I think you should also have an explanation for how the control deck beats the aggro deck. And in that case, it might be you lead on key cards. It might be that you have really cheap, efficient removal. It might be whatever. But I think you need like a mental model to describe how every matchup is won and lost in all directions. And then to assume that any one of those directions is somehow intrinsic to the nature of the game, I think is deeply flawed. And there's a lot of evidence that like that's just not the case.
I don't know. I mean, to me, it feels very intuitive if we just imagine a very simple card pool. So obviously there's a lot of complex interactions, you know, we have all these other aspects that inform who's favored in a particular matchup. And it does come down to a lot of small things, you know, oh, Delver happens to be good. If this, you know, card that is good that also happens to kill Delver easily is also good, well, there's going to be this weird skew in the meta. But if we just take like a really simplified card pool of some creatures, you know, you've got some bears and some big bears and small bears, it does make sense that, you know, if you're playing a bunch of cheap creatures, if I just say, okay, I don't need to play quite as small creatures, I can take a turn off or two and then play a slightly larger creature. Now my larger creature negates multiple of your spells. So that is sort of the setup of this value versus tempo equation. And the key part there, I think, is that the life total exists. There is this really key resource that, because players each begin with this resource of 20 life, the player who's playing a slightly slower deck can say, I will trade having higher card quality and losing some tempo because I can use a little bit of that resource to get on the board later with bigger things that negate more of your cards at once. And then you can take that to the logical of extreme of, well, now I'm going to play not just three drops, I'm just going to play four drops and then five drops. And you could play this game back and forth until someone says, okay, well, now I can actually destroy your entire life total before you get on the board. And that sort of sets up that
system. We spend too much time together. That's exactly where I was going, right? Like, I think that's the other place this idea comes from, is that if you imagine, I was going to describe it as a meta where everybody only has vanilla creatures that have power and toughness equal to their mana cost, right? And so you've got the deck full of one
mana. Right, as I clearly described, bears and big bears and small bears.
Right, well, I mean, you just imagine like a deck full of nothing but one mana 1/1s goes up a deck full of nothing but two mana 2/2s. The two mana 2/2 deck is going to destroy the one mana 1/1 deck. I would argue that the one mana 1/1 deck can never win. It's just impossible.
It's going to be, your opponent's going to have to mulligan a lot.
Yeah, even on a really horrible opening hand, you have to get really, basically it's an unwinnable matchup. Then you can take that same next step and say, okay, well, now he's deck full of nothing but 3 mana 3/3s. The 3 mana 3/3 deck is going to beat both those decks, I would argue.
That's my favorite deck.
And then you can go to the 4 mana 4/4s, like you said, and just imagine at some point, now if your deck is playing only 5 mana 5/5s, that deck full of 1 mana 1/1s is just going to get you dead before you can play enough 5 mana 5/5s to block their horde of 1/1s, right? And that 1 mana 1/1 deck is also going to be completely hellbent by turn 3. They're going to have played all of their cards because they're basically committing to doing things early. If your meta is only vanilla creatures or, you know, only very, very simple cards, then yes, that is where the idea comes from. But of course, Magic is not and has never been that. That's not what Magic is. There's removal spells, there's interaction. And so like that very basic idea that relates to just creatures on board, assuming no interaction, that is an explanation for how a metagame could break down. But that's not anywhere near a comprehensive explanation of how Magic works, right? That's just one aspect of how this rock, paper, scissors cycle could potentially play out.
Right, but I mean, a lot of formats, creature combat is relevant, so even if that is not the be-all, end-all of a format, that is one force, don't you think?
Yeah, it's a force, but I don't know. I think it's just that, like, there's plenty of standard formats where I really don't think that is a force. I think, for example, the standard, and I don't watch a lot of standards, so it's hard for me sometimes to have strong reference points, but I did watch a bit of the standard when Omnath was a thing before it got banned. And in that standard format, I think that's completely irrelevant. Like, that standard format was just big swinging giant decks that were both just trying to combine their cards. They were basically all combo decks to some degree. Not like two card to win the game combos, but there were these intense, extremely powerful synergies, and every deck was just trying to go big and basically be the first one to resolve an expansion explosion for 23 or whatever against their opponent. This was the same, like, Fires of Invention, I believe, meta. Like, that whole meta, like, it's entirely possible to construct standard metas, and there have been plenty over the history of time where that's just not a factor. It doesn't matter that your creatures, small creatures, lose to big creatures in combat. That just never comes up.
Right. I mean, and are there any other forces that we could attribute this kind of access to other than just creatures? There must be, right?
Ask the question in a different way.
So we propose one theory of where this kind of emergent force can come from, which is blocking and life totals, and the fact that you have this, like, padding of your life total that allows you to stabilize and take a little bit of a tempo loss. Are there other things other than creature combat that create that kind of force?
Yeah, I think cheap interaction is the same kind of thing. Again, this all comes down to just what are the most powerful cards in these categories, right? Legacy is largely defined by having Force of Will in the format and having Brainstorm in the format. These just happen to be, like, extremely powerful examples of counter magic and card selection spells that define an entire meta. If you take away one of those cards or both of those cards, like, Legacy would have to be completely reshuffled. It would look completely different. The dominant decks would totally change, because it's not that those kind of decks are just inherently good in Legacy. It's that those are great cards. And so you play the good cards, then you're going to beat your opponent. So I do think that the same way that the curve of threats and their relative sizes and effects on life total can affect how this sort of clock works, I think the same is true for the kind of interaction and removal you have, because that's kind of like the opposing force that, like, runs against the grain of the creatures and threats.
Right. I guess I'm also just wondering, though, if that same kind of thing could happen, like, maybe you literally take out creatures. You know, Magic is Richard Garfield intended. Creatures are not the only thing. We got artifacts and enchantments and all kinds of cool stuff. Can you create that same kind of tension? And I don't know yet. That's the thing I want to think about.
Yeah, I think you definitely can. And I'm just now thinking of, like, the early days of degenerate combo decks where, like, creatures really were irrelevant, right? I'm thinking back to, of course, my favorite Brian Davis versus Bob Maher finals, where between both decks they had no creatures after sideboards, or I think Bob maybe still had one Shard Phoenix because he was technically an Oath deck. But
ooh, Shard Phoenix.
Yeah, that and Morphling were the key threats of the day. Creature combat was not a thing, right? It was a deck that was trying to combo off, which is essentially the aggro in the same structure, right? Brian Davis's Necro deck was just trying to resolve a Necropotence and draw enough cards off Necropotence to outpace all of Bob Maher's answers. Bob Maher was playing what was a control deck in that matchup. If you looked at it now, you'd be like, what even is this deck? Is it a control deck? I don't even know. It's just got a weird suite of, like, toolboxy answers. And it was basically trying to take apart enough of the pieces of Brian's deck that it kind of just self-destructs and he necrolocks himself and the deck doesn't do anything. So I do think you can have that same relationship where it's like, The aggro deck is just the one that is, like, presenting the threat. It is the one that is trying to make your life total the thing that matters first. And if you are trying to answer that threat, it can be in the form of just playing slightly larger creatures, and that's how you answer it, or it can be in the form of the massive suite of interaction removal we have over the course of Magic's history to change the tide of how a game is going to play out.
You know, another place where I feel like we do see this pretty concretely, and I wonder if you'll disagree, is when a new limited format comes out, I feel like very often we see people are trying things out, people are exploring, and I think there's often a trend towards getting slower and doing the bigger, splashier things, figuring out new ways to generate value and what are the sweet things you can do in the format. And then I feel like there often is this pretty quick break where people will start to say, okay, here's how to draft the aggro deck in this format, and suddenly I can take advantage of all these people that are trying to do the slow, dirtily, sweet things. And then that sort of comes into this interesting balance. But I do feel like that shift demonstrates that how in a format that admittedly looks a lot closer to pile of vanilla creatures than Vintage or Legacy, we do sort of see this effect play out.
I honestly have not been following enough limited metagames lately to say that for sure. I have felt that for sure on metagames I have followed in the past, but that was, you know, years ago where I was actually playing enough limited to have a sense of that. It kind of is true that just people in general don't like playing aggro. I think if you were to look at the types of decks that where there is a delta between people's willingness to draft them and their, like, overall win percentage, I think in most formats, the deck that people don't want to draft but wins more than people draft it is almost always one of the faster decks. People just in general, don't like being the one to propose threats, broadly speaking.
Yeah, you mentioned that in Commander, people don't like to attack, and I've played a little bit more Commander recently than I have in a very long time, and people, yeah, will just not make completely free, reasonable attacks.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting...
They just won't do it.
And there might be some other forces there about not wanting to be a threat, but I'm just like, come on, attack me. Get in here. The other thing that I think is really interesting about this is I really sort of enjoy, not when it's a completely rock, paper, scissors environment. It's just, you know, you can't win if you have the A deck against the B deck, but you can always beat the C deck. But I do like when that tempo versus value tension is there. And I really love when it is not guaranteed. So like in a lot of limited formats, just game to game, your deck will say, well, actually, I have a pretty aggressive hand. I might be able to just put enough pressure on my opponent that I can give up on some value here. Or on the other hand, you know, you might just decide the only way you're going to win a game is by stabilizing and outvaluing your opponent. So you might take some early losses in order to make that happen. So to me, that's a really fun part. Those moments of change about the game, and it's a big thing I try and make happen in a lot of my own cube designs.
Yeah, I agree. I think those are some of the most fun games. Like, I think of like friend of the show, Parker, his cube is especially like a mid-range mirror cube, which obviously is just one way to frame it. There is still going to be faster and slower decks in Parker's format. So there are still aggressive decks and there are still controlling decks by the speed axis we're talking about. But I think what Parker's trying to do is like narrow the distance between those fastest and slowest decks. So in any given matchup, you could, based on your draw, change your strategy and, you know, be flexible in terms of what you're actually trying to accomplish. So I don't know if I've convinced the listeners or you yet, but I want to go through each of these matchups one by one. I'm going to leave combo to the side. I still think combo is very different. I also haven't come up with a grand unified theory of Magic metagames to describe where I think there's an elegant explanation for what combo is. To me, that still feels like it's a different axis. It's kind of like how the deck aims to win, not necessarily what speed it operates at, where all these other ones are explicitly about speed. But I'm going to go through each of these matchups and describe how those matchups are won by each deck. Does that seem like a reasonable thing to do?
I think so. I mean, it's getting very concrete where I feel like we can talk about this abstractly as a force that is sometimes a relevant starting point to talk about these matchups. But I agree that once we get into a lot of concrete examples, it just stops becoming the most meaningful thing to look at.
Yeah, and to be clear, like, there's a lot of ways these can't be won. This is like one example. So let's just start doing it, and then I think you could pick it apart and explain why it doesn't make any sense. Because I think there's a lot to get into here. So let's start with like the easy ones. And by the easy ones, I mean the ones I think most people accept, which come from this heuristic, this bias people have towards how this thing is supposed to work. So aggro beating control. I think we can probably agree that most aggro decks will beat most control decks by deploying all of their threats early, spending all of their resources on cards that pressure their opponent's life total, and essentially getting their life total to zero before their opponent is able to execute their strategy. Now, of course, in a given format, there's a lot of ways you can do that. That can look like a lot of different things, but I think fundamentally what the aggro deck is trying to do in the control matchup is just get their opponent dead before all their cards matter.
Abstractly, yeah, I agree.
All right. Mid-range beating aggro. I think this one could be explained by the sort of creature curve we were talking about earlier. And it doesn't have to be creatures, right? This could be planeswalkers, any kind of threat. If you are playing threats that are a little bigger than your opponent's threats, just a little bigger, and the game plays out with sort of a natural back and forth, then when your opponent plays their aggressive one-drop creatures and you have good two-drops and three-drops that can block profitably and not trade, just eat your opponent's creatures in combat, then your opponent is put on the back foot. Your aggro opponent is basically put on the back foot and forced to answer your creatures before they can actually get through and deal any damage. And so in that matchup, mid-range, I think, often beats aggro just by having slightly larger threats that line up profitably in combat against the average threat from their opponent's deck, thus making a lot of their cheap threats, which are the bread and butter of that aggro deck, kind of irrelevant.
I'll buy it.
No criticisms yet?
I mean, again, that is the generally accepted wisdom, and I agree that in a lot of specific contexts, you know, creatures get unblockable, or you just have a burn in your deck, and there are a lot of complex wrinkles, but as
we'll
a baseline... I'm with you.
And then control beating mid-range. And I think this matchup is basically described by the tempo exchange of cheap interaction, be it counter magic or removal, for more expensive threats. We just define the mid-range deck as playing slightly more expensive, slightly more valuable cards than the aggro deck. Then the control deck, theoretically, whose life total will not be under early pressure because these threats are a little bigger, will have time to draw the cards it needs and will be able to repeatedly trade cheaper removal or cheaper counter magic for more expensive cards from their opponent until they are eventually able to resolve their bigger threats even, right? Because the control finishers are going to be even bigger threats than their opponent's mid-range threats.
Sure.
All right. Let's go the other direction then. So how does aggro beat mid-range? Do you have thoughts? I don't want to give a lecture here.
I mean, I think that that tendency for the mid-range deck to be a little bit favored does still hold up to me. But, you know, obviously you have interaction ways to push through damage that it can still win. I don't know that I have a great answer for, like, the canonical, this is how you change your plan in this matchup.
I don't think there's one canonical answer. I think very often you will see aggro decks doing one of a couple things. One is introducing a lot of evasion. Just things to negate blockers. So right. if the way that you're supposed to stabilize is by having profitable blocks, and I make those blocks not matter by having flying, by having menace, by having whatever I want to have in my given environment, that can oftentimes give the aggro deck the edge against the mid-range deck, because the mid-range deck is not often going to be able to, by the ways we've defined these decks, like race. So if you can't block, you also can't really attack profitably, then your cards just become irrelevant to this. So I think evasion is a big one. I think another one is just reach in the form of direct damage to your opponent's face. So as we've described these decks with the way they theoretically function, the aggro decks can be able to get in some damage on their mid-range opponent, but then eventually the mid-range opponent is going to be able to turn the corner or whatever and set up a favorable board state where they know they're going to be drawing bigger creatures and their opponent can no longer attack. If you have ways to get in that reach damage without having to get into combat, be that burn spells or things like Sulfuric Vortex or other ways that drain your opponent. We have that new Black Saga from Neon Dynasty that I know is very exciting in the limited format and seeing a lot of play. Anything that just attacks your opponent's life without having to actually get into combat, I think, will also do that there. And the third way I think that aggro decks can beat their mid-range opponents can be to just have a backup strategy to audible into, oftentimes in the form of like a powerful synergy. So if your mid-range deck is defined by mostly playing threats and maybe not having as many answers as a control deck, and you have specific two-card combinations or multiple-card combinations that essentially allow you to fight this deck on multiple axes, then you actually can't afford to go to the late game and you say, okay, I'm just going to keep recurring my Pyrite Spellbound with my Lurrus, and even though I can't attack you anymore, I'm just eventually going to grind you out with these little synergies. Or I've got my Bitter Blossom on my Skull Clamp. I'm just going to draw enough cards that normally these cards would just be killing you, but now I've turned them into something else.
It's Future Andy here from the editing table, realizing I forgot what is the most obvious way for aggro to beat mid-range decks, which is just simply to have a lot of removal for their blockers. I just overlooked it and thought I had to add it in the edit. Creature removal.
Again, to me, whether the aggro deck is favored or not in the mid-range matchup, in a given meta, a given cube, whatever, just comes down to whether or not these things are present or not. And if they are present, then it might be that the aggro deck is heavily favored against the mid-range deck. And if they're not present, then it might be that the mid-range deck is heavily favored against the aggro deck.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of what you're saying comes down to, are there options for a plan B? And that comes down to a lot of individual cards and individual card interactions, where if we're talking about our toy example of a bunch of vanilla creatures, there's just no opportunity for a plan B. So that kind of aggro mid-range control rock, paper, scissors environment, I think, will develop. Whereas in real Magic, there just is so many other textures.
I don't know if I would call it a plan B, because if you look at like evasion and burn spells.
But if it's not a plan B, why aren't you doing that to begin with? Like usually it's
I'm saying you absolutely can be.
Well, maybe you're giving up some trade-off of saying, well, if I want the evasive creature, it has, you know, one less toughness or one less power. So it's not as effective a plan to, you know, just kill the straw man, but it has more flexibility. Because otherwise you're just saying these decks are good and all equally matched up against each other, which is maybe what you're trying to convince me of in the end. But
I think within a given meta, you can figure out, all right, let's say here's the standard. Let's say we've lumped these decks into aggro, these decks into mid-range, these decks into control. I think you can figure out, all right, in this standard pool, the way that these decks have shaken out, these are the favorite matchups, right? And those might break down on any axis. I'm saying there's nothing intrinsic to the game that says that, well, we have to assume the mid-range deck can beat the aggro deck unless something else happens. And I think you're thinking like a game designer, right? Where you're like, well, if I'm playing the evasive creatures, I had to give up something, right? Maybe you didn't. Delver of Secrets
right,
is a one-man creature
I'm saying,
with
like,
flying.
Ragavan, just a dumb card.
Right. Maybe you didn't have to give everything up. Maybe that's just how the deck works, right? It just naturally has a bunch of evasive threats, and you want them against control, you want them against mid-range, and so you just have a good aggro deck that just has favorite matchups. That's entirely possible. How does mid-range beat control, then?
get more aggro, or play carefully around wraths.
So here I think the first thing is, yeah, just, you know, embrace the fact that you are actually the aggressive person in this matchup.
Ignore it. Keep turning those creatures sideways.
Right. Even if, you know, theoretically you think of yourself as a mid-range deck, which effectively means you think there are some matchups where you want to be going slower than your opponent. In this matchup, you have to recognize that you are actually supposed to be going fast. And so here I think having cheap creatures that can get in the red zone and basically put your opponent on the back foot is really valuable. I also think in these matchups, mid-range decks often thrive by resolving key spells that do generate a lot of value, where if your opponent's whole plan is going to be to just answer all of your threats until they can resolve their big finisher, you just have to make it too hard to answer all of your threats by playing things that are 2-for-1s or offer value in the face of removal, be it counter magic or, you know, actual removal spells, like stuff that basically has some counterplay. The key card I think of here that is just, like, to me, like a quintessential mid-range card is Lingering Souls. I say quintessential mid-range card because it's just so hard for any deck to deal with, right? And you can play it in control decks, you can play it in aggro decks, but like that card is good against counter magic, it's good against removal spells, it's good against blockers, it's got evasion, like it just kind of does everything. And those are the kind of cards I think you want in a mid-range deck. You want cards that can basically play both sides of the coin. So when you're playing against a control deck, you can say, I'm spending mana to make 2 1/1s with flying, and if you counter it, I'm just going to spend it again because I now have drawn another spell basically off that card you countered, and I'm going to get more threats. And then once I've got 1/1s in play, what are you going to do about it? Are you going to waste a wrath on them? Are you going to spend individual counter or individual removal spells on them? It just poses a big problem for your opponent who's trying to answer all of your threats.
Lingering Souls is a good magic card.
Lingering Souls is a rude magic card. And again, in that case, it's like, for example, in the like Omnath standard, you could describe all of those decks as mid-range decks because they were all trying to go big, but they weren't really playing a lot of answers. And it was just, yeah, no one can answer Omnath. Like trying to counterspell or remove Omnath is a complete non-starter because if you have any window where your opponent can resolve it, you just lose so much value that you can't possibly come back. And so because of that, in that meta, mid-range or whatever you want to describe was heavily favored against anything that was controlling, so you just didn't play those control decks. They weren't really present in that meta.
Right. Yeah, you're touching on another thing which I think might be a really relevant bias. So I think maybe we both agree that in this toy example, these categories are useful, but when we apply that to a real-world metagame, I think that oftentimes you could say, okay, there is this rock, paper, scissors meta, except if one deck just has unwinnable matches, that might just not be a feature of the meta. People just won't play that. So I think maybe even if these terms are quote unquote useful, they're useful only in describing a set of decks that might just not be played. So actually not useful when you're talking about, you know, maybe it's useful given here's a random set of cards from a meta. How is this going to be favored against other random sets of cards, but not useful when you're talking about a meta that's actually evolved and iterated and sort of reached its local maximum.
Yeah, I do still think, except for really unhealthy metas where like everybody's playing the mirror basically because everyone's agreed there's exactly one good deck, if there is a spread of viable decks, I think almost always that spread is going to be somewhat on the speed spectrum, even if it's a much narrower range on that speed spectrum than like some meta that has extremely fast aggro with like really slogging control. And actually, I think from my experience, like just observing standard metagames, I don't think there actually tends to be a huge range very often. I think most standards kind of have a speed that evolves, and the fast decks just have to be on the fast end of that like speed mean, and the control decks just have to be on the slightly slower end of that speed mean, but they're actually all kind of, you know, somewhat close. So the aggro decks from a slow meta might be the mid-range or control decks from a much faster meta, right? It's all like local to each individual metagame. But yeah, I agree. I think it entirely comes down to the cards that get played, right? Like, it's not that the new standard set comes out and everyone goes and says, well, let's see if aggro is viable. Someone might do that, but I would argue that's the wrong way to like go about breaking a metagame. I think it's just find the powerful cards, find the decks that have the most combinations of most powerful cards, and then these ideas are just emergent from people observing over time enough patterns of how decks have favored or unfavored matchups to describe what a deck might do in the abstract.
Yeah, I think we're kind of going in rock, paper, scissors circles around the subject.
I'm teaching this semester, I teach a little bit of college-level graphic design, and I really underestimate how much just repeating things is so important. So I hope people are not bored by us kind of covering these same ideas a couple times, but I think the repetition is important to me. The last one we haven't covered yet is just how control beats aggro. And to me, this one is entirely a question of just what the interaction suite looks like in the meta. So I think aggro is going to be very favored against control in a metagame where the interaction can't efficiently answer aggro's threats, right? And this is where the mana system, I think, comes into play, where in a lot of metagames, the aggro decks are playing good one mana spells, right? I think that oftentimes determines like the fastest deck is what are the best one mana spells. Unless you're talking about a really slow meta where none of the one mana spells in the entire card pool are viable, you're going to be playing the cheapest threats you can if you're trying to be the fast deck. So it really comes down to the question of, does the control deck have cards that are viable to answer those one and two mana threats without taking a huge mana disadvantage, right? And so if you have a bunch of cheap interaction, especially interaction that answers multiple things, like Forked Bolt does a really good job in any kind of meta with creatures with one toughness, just completely dumpstering aggro decks, because it's one mana, kill two creatures very often. So if you have removal like this floating around, or if you have really efficient board wipes that can answer multiple threats at once, then control decks can oftentimes have a huge upper hand over aggro. It's actually something I felt in my own cube. If I had to describe my own cube right now, I think that control is heavily favored against aggro, and it's something I've actually been thinking about a little bit and trying to pay some attention to, where it feels like I've got a lot of really cheap interaction because I love cheap spells. I love letting my players cast multiple spells a turn, make sequencing decisions about when to cast stuff rather than just casting things whenever they have enough mana to do it. And as a result, it's entirely possible that your aggro deck just faces like three or four one mana removal spells, and just how many opening hands from any aggro deck can beat three or four one mana removal spells. And just, you can't, right? It's just something you can't often do. So that's something I've actually been thinking about a lot, is how to make aggro good in the face of that. And that's where you get into all the stuff like Giver of Runes and Mother of Runes and Odonto Vanguard and the other one that you can discard a card to make it indestructible. These cards that negate some of that removal. And there's this big counterplay, but to me, it's just so obvious that there is no intrinsic way this sort of matchup chart works. It just entirely comes down to the cards that are in the format. And it may be that the explanations in one direction are a little more elegant. You just say, you go under your opponent. And that's easier than saying you have enough cheap removal to make your opponent's threats irrelevant. And then once you're top decking, your deck is heavily favored when you're top decking because you have more expensive cards, you have card advantage, you have card draw. And so you just get the game to a neutral state on turn four, and you'll pretty much win from there most of the time. That's maybe not as elegant an idea, so it's not as sticky. But to me, it's just so obvious that as cube designers that are constructing our own metas, we have total control over how those matchups work. And it's not that we're fighting against some intrinsic tide. It's just that the cards you put in the cube are going to determine how these matchups break down.
I still think there is an intrinsic tide. I just agree that there are also many other forces that can overcome and maybe overwhelm it.
What is the context where this intrinsic tide exists? Is it just in this abstract model in our heads where we only have vanilla creatures?
I think it still impacts creature-focused formats where you don't
necessarily have... Is it basically like retail limited? Is that where this thing comes up most?
I think so. I feel this a lot, I think, actually, in certain matchups in my own cube as well, in regular cube, where it's like, yep, I just drafted a little bit too slow and was a turn too slow for a lot of these decks, but did well in these matchups against decks that were a little bit slower, which isn't good data. That's just like, I felt it happening, and I felt like, oh, okay, this is why someone who did better with this deck is, you know, like you're saying, picked the right relevant cards that targeted those weaknesses, so they were able to draft the slow deck that still won. But I think that as a starting point, that was still a useful framework to think about particular decks.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I think these ideas are true. They hold up. It's just that they only describe half of the matchups, and I think the explanations for why a deck wins are 100% rock solid, great abstract explanations for how Magic decks can interact. I think the assumption that and it always goes this way, or it's always favored in this direction, is the part that I would question.
It definitely doesn't always go that way. I think that I would underscore more than anything, just say, these are potentially useful tools. How useful? I think we're not quite there yet. But
I think, all this stuff I think is really useful to think about. I just think as soon as you resign yourself and say, well, you know, aggro is just favored against mid-range.
Right.
That's like, where you've, like, you're not learning anything anymore. You're not making any progress in your understanding of the game. You've just decided to check this little binary box because that very simple idea is appealing. Humans are drawn to simple explanations, and the explanation that just aggro can't beat mid-range, it's always going to be disfavored, is a clean idea, and it's not as simple as that. And people don't like to accept the fact that it's actually not that simple.
Right. I mean, like any heuristics or other mental tools, it might be useful sometimes, but it is just a tool. It is not the literal description of what is happening. And so if that tool stops working, pick up a different tool.
All right, well, that's it for this very dense, theory-laden episode of Lucky Paper Radio. This is the stuff that makes me love Cube, Anthony, because we can observe this about constructed metagames, and I think it's interesting to watch people write about these ideas as it pertains to constructed, but they're ultimately powerless. All they get to do is look at the best decks and say, like, I would describe that as an aggro deck. we get to decide what cards we put in our environment and how these ideas actually interact with each other. And I actually would describe my main cube, the Bun Magic Cube, as like a long form exploration of really pushing these kinds of decks to their extremes. Like, I would say I've always really strived to push my aggro decks to be as fast as possible, my control decks to be as controlling and threat light as possible, like just to really kind of push these things all the way to their extremes and see what happens. And I don't know, my experience has been that it depends on what cards are in your deck. There is no intrinsic grain to who's going to win or lose, especially with the kinds of cards I'm playing with, because individual cards are powerful enough to completely turn the tide of a whole matchup. And so it really just comes down to how things line up more than anything.
Right.
One last thing I do want to say here is I also think that this axis we've described does get differently and oftentimes less relevant at higher power levels.
I agree. I mean, just because there are so many other forces, like we're talking about this force that works in this toy example, but the further away you get from that toy example, the more other forces you have. And just, when you have these cards that generate a tremendous amount of tempo and value at the same time, it just doesn't, that axis isn't as meaningful anymore, I don't think.
And I'm just like thinking about the Degenerate Micro Cube, like, is it even appropriate to describe a turn zero flash and a world spine worm as anything regarding tempo or value? Like, it's just
no, it's meaningless. It's not even magic. It's just a big thing. Worm coil engine.
It's neither thing. It's not world spine worm, not worm coil engine. Different worm.
Too many worms.
It's just, you know, a two card combination that says your opponent almost certainly loses the game now, unless they have balance or toxic deluge and they want to take a bunch of damage. So you could really like try and bend over backwards to describe an environment like that in these terms, but like I wouldn't try to. I don't think these ideas apply to the Degenerate Micro Cube. I think that cube is entirely dictated by specific card interactions, which as you get to more powerful individual cards, more of the questions come down to specific card interactions and less of them come down to this abstract navigation of a tempo or value axis.
I mean, this is a whole other topic, but I think one of the big factors there is that Magic is a game of small numbers, and the smaller you make those numbers, because we're talking about integers, the fewer little variations and relationships you can have, and interactions tend to be more all or nothing, because you just have a one or a zero or a two, whereas if you're talking about quote-unquote less, I mean, we're literally less powerful cards, you know, your 5-mana 4-5 versus your 5-mana 5-4, there is a lot of little variation you can have.
I think we can agree a 5-mana 5-5 is objectively worse than 3 5-5s with trample for 2-mana at instant speed.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That then shuffles the combo right back into your library. It just shuffles the worm Rude. Back. I don't think it shuffles it's not the Eldrazi. Anyway, I love talking about this kind of stuff, and that's why I love Cube, is because we get to not just talk about it, but like actually get our hands dirty and fiddle around and play with it. And if you out there listening feel like there is a natural grain to the favorite and disfavored matchups in your cube, it doesn't have to be that way. You can just put some different cards in there and make decks worse or make other decks better.
That is definitely always true.
You might not think Deadweight is like really cool and sexy, but if you want your control decks to stomp all over aggro decks, just put Deadweight and Disfigure, Sun Lance, all these cards that people are like, not as exciting as Swords of Plowshares. Sure, maybe it's not. But if you find that your control decks are getting run over by aggro and you want to fix that, put more Deadweights in there.
Is that relevant because those cards are less useful in the aggro versus mid-range matchup, so the control deck specifically gets a profit?
Yes, I think so.
That was a long yes.
That's a complicated question, but yeah, I think your decks will prioritize removal at different rates. And to me, in like my environment, I think control decks prioritize removal the most because a big part of the strategy is contingent upon being able to answer any type they need to answer. I think aggro and mid-range decks will both prioritize it less, and it will depend on what their deck already looks like, what their curve looks like, what kind of answers they have, but even more so than in control, you want the right number of removal spells in your aggro and mid-range deck, and ideally you want ones that are flexible that can answer a wide variety of things.
Right.
Less so than a Deadweight. I'll still probably play a Deadweight in my aggro deck, let's be honest, but I'm not going to take it as highly as I will if I'm a control deck, and so you end up getting me through the control deck. And also, you just have a bunch of these things running around, so my overall point is that everyone's in control of this stuff, and the thought technologies are useful, but they have limits, and it's fun to talk about.
That I'll agree with.
All right, great. On that bombshell, this concludes this episode of Lucky Paper Radio. All of our music is produced by DJ James Nasty. All of Magic Cards are produced by Wizards of the Coast. This podcast is produced by thinking oh so very hard about thought technologies and words we make up to describe patterns we observe in the game we love.
Okay, Merlin,
and then
man.
Talking about it into microphones in Anthony's basement. I am nothing but a combination of all of the things that have influenced me, Anthony. I'm just going to call you Harold McGee from now on. You're just Harold McGee.
Oh, my God. That's the greatest compliment I could be awarded. Harold McGee, if you play Magic the Gathering, you want to be on a podcast. Sometimes I wonder if Randall Monroe plays Magic.
I think Randall has definitely cast some spells in his day, whether he's still actively playing Magic or not. I feel like, here's the thing about Randall. I feel like Randall would be interested in Magic for the same reasons we are, but then he would just be too cool for it. He'd be like, oh, this is
neat. I'm going to move on to this other thing.
Well, yeah, he'd be like, oh, yeah, it's kind of a fun game. I like it. It's really cool. But like spending $20 on like a piece of cardboard and like all this stupid drama on Magic Twitter, like I'm just going to go build a telescope or something, whatever Randall does.
He draws comics about telescopes.
Sure.